Welcome everyone to another episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I am Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Anik Ahmed, Deepak's friend.
Oh, I have a friend. With all this lockdown that's been happening, it's nice that I still maintain some sort of friendship with some people.
I'm still figuring out what my role is in this podcast, Deepak.
But, you know, it doesn't have to be pressured. Like, just take your time. We'll figure out. We'll get there. You know, by the end of the season, we'll be like, okay, yeah, I'm this guy. I'm as you said, I think in the last episode, he said, I'm the non-academic. So, yeah. Let's see.
I think that's the most accurate description so far.
Yeah.
Because I don't really know what I do every day at work, so.
And nor do the people that work under you. And
they don't know either.
Hey, are you like, why am I asking?
Who is this guy?
you gotta figure that existential crisis out as soon as possible if it's affecting work.
I'll use Christmas to self-reflect and do a bit of introspection, and when we come back over Christmas, I'll have a new title. I think
it is the Christmas time, isn't it? This is our December episode. This is our Christmas episode. So, you know, Merry Christmas to everyone already. Get in the festive spirit. It's happening now. As I say, officially, December is the time to embrace Christmas and the Christmas spirit. Anything before that is a no-no. But yeah, time to relax. Looking forward to the end of the year, just taking it easy a little bit. It's been a crazy year. It's been pretty busy, hectic, and pretty stressful in its, you know, weird and crazy ways. So, you know, it's nice to maybe just take a bit of time off and enjoy, you know, a bit of chill time.
And we've done a lot this year. And just thinking about the podcast when we started, whenever that was, back in that May or even before that, when we kind of incepted the idea, right? Obviously, we took a bit of time to get it out there.
Yeah.
But just thinking back when we sat in that room,
yeah,
for 3-4 hours going through your thesis, what's been really cool actually is like all the stuff we've issued so far, there's been so much news out there that relates to all these interviews we've had, right? And just recently with Anna's episode four that we had recently on kind of social media influencers and the relationship with obesity, the BBC ran an article recently on kind of some of the new rules that they're planning to put in place for digital marketing of kind of foods and high in sugar and fats and so on. So I'm finding that's just really cool. That stuff's really current that we're working on, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's what's really exciting and happy for me to know that we aren't just looking at topics that aren't discussed about right now and with a lot of urgency. We actually are. I mean, we're having a lot of articles come out, a lot of the kind of public conversation be around some of the subjects and topics that we've been discussing in the last 4 episodes, which is great and it's fantastic. So it means that, you know, we're doing something relevant, which is important. And for me, I always feel like the podcast can be an opportunity for a lot of people just to get a little bit more knowledge and understanding about these big topics, about these big issues. So we are talking to the experts that really know what's going on in these aspects and these big problems or these pressing matters within our world right now. So this is a really great opportunity, not, you know, just for the academic community, but for everyone to understand what's really happening and get in the thick of it, which is great.
And talking of academic influencers, do we need to send a shout out to someone who just passed their Viva recently, Deepak?
Yes, my fiance, Diana Munoz, she has passed her Viva. She's having a pretty amazing year. Doctor, she's going to get married to this guy. So, yeah, no, she's done really well. She did really well. From having a few chats with her supervisor, it seemed like her thesis was fantastic. And again, I wasn't surprised. She was a bit nervous about it all, but she really smashed it out of the park for sure. So congratulations to her big time.
And what was her kind of focus area?
Why have you put me on the spot? No, I'm joking. So she this is a big test for me. She did her research on malaria and why the immune system strengthens after a second or third infection.
The good thing about this podcast is that she can't She can't be here to verify what you're saying, so we're going to assume it's true.
Yeah, but she's like our number one fan, because she's always retweeting our links and you know, always promoting us. So I've got to get that right. So yeah, she's done some really interesting, exciting research in terms of just looking at how the body actually reacts to malaria. Yeah. And I think from what I can gather from the research, it's the first infection tends to be the most serious one, but then after that, it seems like the body seems to develop a resistance to the infection. And she was doing research on that, which is really cool. Did some really cool clinical trials at Oxford. So yeah, it was really exciting.
Well, it sounds pretty fantastic. And we wish her good luck on her kind of next part of her journey. But obviously, it's all about our podcast today. Yeah. What are we talking about on this episode, Deepak?
So we've got a really interesting guest talking about the influence of international law on the West African region during the 19th century. So our guest has just released a book, which is really exciting, really fascinating. We're going to talk about the book, and that's going to be really the kind of main focal point. But this episode, this interview is really about looking at how we talk about our histories, our understanding of what went on in the past and how that's affecting the modern day. So it's a really challenging and thought-provoking episode, and I'm excited for our listeners to hear what we've got in store for them.
Let's get on to the episode then.
Let's do it. Welcome everyone to this interview installment of the House of Wisdom podcast. In this episode, we are interviewing Dr. Inge van Uhle, who's an assistant professor of legal history at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. Prior to joining Tilburg University, she worked as a PhD research assistant at the Department of Roman Law and Legal History at Leuven, where she obtained her PhD in 2016. Her area of expertise is international legal theory and international legal history, with a particular interest in colonialism and West Africa. And perhaps most importantly, Inge is from Belgium, and she's very proud of that. Inge, it's a pleasure to have you on. How are you?
Good. Thank you for this introduction. I'm great. Thank you for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. It's going to be an exciting episode for sure. We've got some really interesting topics to talk about. Before we get into that, though, we've got some lighthearted questions. And the first one is, if you were in the House of Wisdom and you were stuck in there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, who would be the person you'd want in there with you? So someone really famous, someone maybe inspiring, dead or alive, you know, who would you choose?
Yeah, so I find that a really hard question, because considering that I've been in a home office for the past 6 months, I already really feel like I'm already in the House of Wisdom and it's taking way too long. So I'm not sure if I would be looking forward to that, but I think it would have to be someone funny and someone inspirational. And because obviously I'm a legal historian, it would have to be a historical figure. So I was thinking Oscar Wilde, because he's an incredibly funny writer and an inspiring person from the perspective of his personal life, as a symbol of LGBT rights. And I think he's a great author, so I hope that he could teach me a thing or two about writing texts. So this is why I would choose Oscar Wilde.
What a choice. I love that choice. I think because there's so many elements of that to break down in terms of, first of all, the writing style and learning a thing or two from Oscar Wilde would be pretty incredible. And definitely, I think we could all do with a bit of help from him to improve our writing style. But then also the stories. I mean, he lived a very interesting and adventurous life. And I think that would be such a cool person to just sit down in the House of Wisdom. I think there is a coffee section, so maybe a coffee section so you guys can share a coffee and just talk out some really cool stories and have some funny stories too, because he was a very witty guy too. So that is a great choice, I feel.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy with this choice. Yeah.
And maybe we can bring along the picture of Dorian Gray as well.
Yeah, the picture of Dorian Gray, or the importance of being earnest, that might be a bit more lighthearted.
And second question, you know, given this topic today and your interest in West Africa, is there a place that you would like to visit on that side of the continent in the future?
Yeah, so I would really like to visit Freetown in Sierra Leone, because it has been on my list and I've been wanting to visit it for the longest of time. So during my PhD research, the plan was to visit Sierra Leone, but then the Ebola epidemic broke out, so I couldn't go. And then I had a trip planned last year, this year. So this was supposed to happen in the winter of 2020. And then it didn't happen again because of the coronavirus. So it's been two epidemics that have been really preventing me from Sierra Leone. So I really like to go and see Freetown.
Yeah, it seems like the viruses are trying to hold you back from visiting. But I'd love to actually visit West Africa. They said a lot of my trips are kind of based around food, and I've made some friends like that are from Ghana, and they made some incredible meals, incredibly spicy. And for someone that loves spicy food, that really did kill me. But it was really spicy. It was so good, and that's made me want to really visit certain parts of West Africa, like Ghana and Sierra Leone. That would be fantastic. So I think there's so much to visit, so much to check out there. And yeah, I think Inga, definitely go for take three next year. Fingers crossed it works out.
Yeah, I hope so too. And on the subject of food, I think certainly it would be interesting to do a culinary tour of West Africa, because each country has a different version of jollof rice. And so far, I think I've not tasted enough of that. So I would certainly like to put that on the to-do list too, the culinary tour of West Africa.
Yeah, I think that would be a really good way of kind of planning your trip around West Africa. That'd be really good. So just kind of a checklist and maybe a kind of a review list of who's got the best jollof rice would be a good idea for sure. That's brilliant. Okay, so having those questions out of the way, we are now going to turn to kind of the key point of discussion about this interview. So Inga has just released her book, Great Britain and International Law in West Africa. In this book, we are able to explore the role of international law in Britain's imperialist expansion into West Africa during the early and mid-19th century. Perhaps what is most fascinating about this book is that it challenges preconceived ideas about the international legal system and the narratives that have often dominated discipline. So Inga, could you maybe just give a little bit of a description and a general summary about the book that you've just released?
Yeah, sure. So the main objective of the book was really to map the way that international law was used by the British in West Africa, but in a period immediately prior to what is generally known as the Scramble for Africa. And so the Scramble for Africa itself was actually a relatively short period of time. So in fact, really only 6 years between the Berlin West Africa Conference of 1884-1885, and then a series of agreements that were concluded in 1890. And this is a really interesting period, of course, certainly for West Africa. However, the early and mid-19th century are formative in terms of the rise of British presence in the region. And so I've shown in the book that they were also formative in terms of the experimentation with legal instruments, such as treaties of cession or extraterritoriality or use of force or protection. And so all of these instruments that would actually become really important during the Scramble for Africa. And so what I've tried to do is take a range of sources into scope that scholars who have looked at empire and international law have left mostly untouched when it comes to West Africa. So these are really governmental correspondence or parliamentary debates, personal letters, and this presents a much more nuanced picture of the development of these legal instruments than if we would limit ourselves to what, for example, only 19th century lawyers had to say about it. And so another major objective of the book was also to dispel with the myth that the creation of empire in West Africa through international law was this monolithic sort of top-down process where you would have these supposedly ready-made legal instruments imposed by the imperial metropole, so by London, essentially. And so what I illustrate is that empire building was really a very haphazard and often a spontaneous process. And often the colonial office or the foreign office had really no idea of what was happening on the ground in Africa. And it was really individuals in the British settlements in West Africa who were the ones that negotiated and applied and interpreted international law as they saw fit in a very close correspondence with what was happening around them. And this group of individuals was incredibly diverse. So these were colonial officials, consuls, merchants, both African and British. They were enslaved peoples, African rulers and missionaries. So there's this whole variety of people that were engaged with the creation of international law in West Africa.
What ignited kind of this imperious ambition to visit West Africa in particular? What was it about that strategic location that all of these countries wanted a piece of it?
Yeah, so the reason why European presence increased during this period, so roughly between the end of the 18th century and then 1884, 1885, when the scramble sets in, is one of the most important reasons is really the abolition of the slave trade. So Europeans had been present on the west coast of Africa since the early modern age. And this was really for the purpose of trade in various commodities, such as ivory and gold, and also obviously the transatlantic slave trade. Now, by the time we get to the end of the 18th century, we see that the slave trade and this condition of slavery is increasingly questioned, and that the spiritual equality of mankind is increasingly emphasized. And a crucial moment here was the year 1807, when both houses of parliament passed the Act for the Abolition of the Slave Trade, which prohibited the import of slaves to British territorial possessions. And it also prescribed the participation of British subjects in the slave trade. But the abolition of the slave trade leaves Britain economically vulnerable because there is now this commercial vacuum that can be filled potentially by another slave trading nation, because Britain at that point in time had been the most important slave trader. So what happens is Britain mounts an international diplomatic campaign to convince other Western states to also suppress the slave trade, which then resulted in this conclusion of a string of bilateral treaties that would prohibit the trade in slaves. But by the 1840s, it becomes clear that this strategy is not satisfactory. And under abolitionist pressure, there's a new approach that is adopted, namely to tackle the supply side of the trade. So in other words, to convince those African polities that were selling enslaved people to European traders to abandon the slave trade. And so what you then see is the increased use of treaties with African rulers that were aimed at replacing the slave trade with so-called legitimate trade with Europeans. And this principle becomes of a much wider application than just West Africa, but it was also used to tackle the Arab slave trade on the east coast of Africa as well. So the abolition of the slave trade really becomes this factor for European presence. But there's also increased scientific interest. So we see a number of exploratory voyages for geographical and biological inquiry. So for example, research trips of the River Niger. And this then adds to a certain sense of adventurism later at the end of the 19th century, where you would have these famous adventurers such as Stanley, Livingstone, Speke, or the Brazza, who all published travel accounts that really fascinated the West. And Africa then becomes this land of opportunity and of raw materials where you can find diamonds and gold. So there's also a commercial attraction. Also with respect to, famously for West Africa, the trade in palm oil, but also rubber, when we move closer to the Congo, for example. And by the end of the 19th century, there was also the development of new medicine, new technology, such as the steamship, the railway, which made the opening up of Africa suddenly a real possibility. So there was this technological incentive too. And then finally, by the end of the 19th century, there's also increased commercial geopolitical competition between European states. So, for example, primarily between Britain and France over Egypt and the Suez Canal. And much of this rivalry spills over to the rest of the African continent. So those are some of the reasons why, by the end of the 19th century, this scramble for African territory set in.
So I think this gives a really great illustration of the advancements that we were seeing with during this period and during this time. And I suppose a very traditional perception of a colonial interaction with Africa generally is that these colonial powers, these European powers, will go in and generally dictate the conversation or dictate the way that international law works and operates within these areas. What I found the most fascinating aspect about your book was, I think it challenges those preconceived notions. It argues that actually West Africans and community leaders had a huge role, an important role to play in the general workings and the development, especially when you mentioned the kind of spontaneity that occurred in the discussions, in the negotiations, in the kind of general development of international law in this region. I think it's really great to see how you've discussed and how you've elaborated on the fact that West Africans themselves had a huge role to play in the development of international and a lot of the developments that you discussed just now. And generally, the voice of West Africa was very vital in what happened during this period.
Yeah, so certainly during this period of experimentation prior to the Scramble for Africa, it's clear that the development of legal instruments was a constant process of interaction and contestation. And certainly when it comes to treaties, for example, African rulers negotiated clauses that were to their advantage, or they would attempt to use the British as allies in their conflicts with African rival polities. But just to be clear, that doesn't mean that this process of imperialism or colonialism was not an inherently violent one in which African peoples were victims. So British coercion was a constant, and it only increased after 1885 when the real scramble for Africa sets in, and this level of coercion and violence increases. But what it illustrates, though, is that African people were not passive recipients of colonial rule. So even after colonial rule is consolidated and British indirect rule sets in, so this is really at the end of the 19th century, this African contestation and subversion of British colonial law remains constant. So African colonial subjects continue to use colonial courts to defend their own rights, or as Mahmoud Mamdani, a really famous philosopher and historian, has also shown, for example, Africans would migrate to regions where the tentacles of this colonial government wouldn't really reach them. But there is very little known about that particular process, so this process of contestation, which also has, I think, an incredibly emancipatory side to the history of international law. So that is also an aspect that I really wanted to investigate in the book.
I mean, you mentioned in your book about that kind of lawyer's tendency to over-systemize and classify a complex past. Could you explain a little bit about the kind of law and history approach that you've taken that has allowed us to better understand West Africa?
Yeah, so law and history essentially means that law is studied in its context. And so I considered this an important approach because most of what we know about the way that international law was used for imperial purposes in Africa is through the writings of 19th or early 20th century Western international lawyers. But most 19th century international lawyers were concerned with describing and analyzing customary international law. And in order to do that properly, you would have to construct order out of the chaos that is imperial state practice. So during this analytical exercise, much nuance lost. There's very little information on how legal instruments were really developed. Generally also, Western international lawyers certainly discussed whether or not international law should or could apply to the non-West. But they talked comparatively little about Africa specifically. So there is actually very little information, real information to be found there. And the Berlin West African Conference and the Berlin Final Act were important exceptions here. They were really heavily debated, as this was also an interesting case study, certainly from the perspective of a title to territory doctrine, for example. But apart from that, there is also the disparaging and often racist manner in which African polities were described by international lawyers. So the advantage of looking at law in context is that it allows you to uncover, for example, these processes of negotiation, of contestation, and of African agency.
And generally, I think that's maybe some of the big issues that we have to face with the kind of historical accounts of international law during this period, that a lot of the accounts that we have that have tended to dominate the mainstream discussion about international law does come from the West, does come from the colonial powers. And for me, reading about this, I feel like at times the colonial powers may have actually exaggerated their role. Perhaps that being one of the reasons why some of the accounts of the various West African individuals and West African communities that played such an important role in the region in terms of international law and their negotiations and their interaction with Great Britain were perhaps slightly toned down. So I think that's a question that we definitely have to look at, and an issue that we have to look at, that the accounts, the historical accounts of much of international law does come from the West, does come from these colonial powers, and they've actually ended up dictating their role and maybe even over-exaggerating how much of an effect that they've had on the international legal system.
Yes, there is definitely this sense of the relevance of the efficiency of international law that you could certainly raise in this perspective. And this also has to do with the fact that much of these international law is obviously focused on the official documents of the state. And if you don't look beyond just the treaties and the official documents, you don't really see this process of negotiation. And this is really important to understand the genesis of international instruments in practice. And it also dispels indeed this idea that there is this monolithic imperial state at which on an essential level, decisions were taken with respect to what needed to happen in West Africa. In practice, we see that it is really these imperial agents and a number of other individuals on the ground who decided very much on the spot and in relation to real problems that they incurred or experienced on a day-to-day business, they really responded very spontaneously with legal solutions on the spot.
And I think this is a particularly great example of the gap between the kind of practicality of international law during the time and the key legal theorists of that period also. So you made mention of Lasse Oppenheim, who is a very important and very key international legal theorist. We still hold him in very high acclaim to this day, who has a very complicated past with the whole idea of civilized and non-civilized nations. And you can definitely feel like his writings are a little bit separate to the actual workings of international law, where there is that practicality, there is that spontaneity, there is that actual collaboration going on between the colonial powers and the West African communities. And I think that's actually an also important aspect to look at too, is that gap between the kind of key vocal voices within international law during the time and the actual practicalities. And then we've got to question some of the key theorists that we hold in such high regard because of this.
Yeah, so there is certainly this difference between how international law concerning Africa was described by 19th century lawyers and how it unfolded in practice. And I think you mentioned Oppenheim, but I think a really good example of this gap is also the example of the doctrine of occupation, where you had really important individuals such as the German international lawyer Ferdinand Martens, who argued that Africa was a territorium nullius because it was not in possession of any powers who belonged to this so-called civilized family of nations, and for that reason that Africa could be occupied. So at the same time, however, in reality, most of this acquisition process developed through treaties of cession, which actually implied a recognition of African sovereignty. So these two positions, so on the one hand, this recognition of sovereignty through treaties, and on the other hand, people like Martens claiming that Africa could be occupied because it was empty, are obviously fundamentally incompatible. And I think this is really important because this question of the gap between theory and practice really indeed illustrates to what extent international lawyers at the time were also driven by a certain ideology, this dogma of this civilized sense of, this idea of the civilized family of nations, which really fed into how they considered African countries as being part of international law or not, or even possessing sovereignty or not.
One of the things you kind of pointed out in some of your responses, Inga, is about the power of the legal instruments that were introduced into West Africa. And And I'm definitely not the legal one, but this was the area that I was quite interested in, and in particular around the model agreement that Britain introduced, and in particular the clauses around use of force. How critical was that for Britain to kind of take its claim over West Africa as it was building its kind of commercial arrangements?
So the model agreement was this standard agreement that was created within the confines of the Foreign Office, actually initially for the purpose of the Niger expedition, so during the 1840s. And indeed, this model agreement tied in with that idea of replacing the slave trade through legitimate commerce, so the legitimate commerce in other goods than enslaved peoples. And this agreement contained indeed clauses that, first of all, would force African polities to abandon the slave trade. But on the other hand, they also had a number of commercial clauses that then tied into this idea of legitimate commerce. So the introduction of privileges to British merchants and the introduction of increased access of British merchants to the African interior. And this was really important, not so much for the presence of, you might say, or the increase of British trade in that sense, because in the end, many of the regions where the model agreement was concluded already had trade relationships with the British or with Europeans, generally speaking. And there's this really important debate between historians to what extent this introduction of legitimate trade really affected the economy, so African economies at the time. So the debate is still ongoing. There's still a lot of questions to be answered there. But I think indeed what is really interesting about the model agreement is that it also had an important coercive force. So this there was often a clause included in the model agreement that stipulated that if African polities continued to trade in slaves, then the slave trade could be put down by force by the Royal Navy. And this, of course, was a really interesting tool. So for British merchants who were trading in the region, because there would be this menacing presence or potential menacing presence of a British gunboat, that would be able to really also protect their interests if need through force.
So international law and its development is clear that it's driven by colonial powers who are going and visiting countries and occupying and exploiting the resources of these countries. And for them to do that in the most efficient way possible, they've established frameworks, which in the research you've kind of performed it through legal frameworks in that case. And so the international law that we have today, it's effectively been developed by ex-colonial powers. And therefore, there's always a bias in these frameworks towards these bigger powers, effectively. Is that something you kind of uncovered or have come across in your research during this time?
Yes, so this is definitely true. So on the one hand, the legal instruments that were used in West Africa by these different individuals, and certainly by, in this case, imperial agents, so the real imperial officials, such as consuls, but also colonial governors and their representatives that were present in West Africa and that defended their own, but also British interests. Many of these had already been used prior to the 19th century. So, for example, treaties were not entirely alien to the commercial relationships in the early modern age between European merchants and African merchants, nor was this idea of extraterritoriality entirely alien to West Africa. So there was already a system of dispute settlement between European communities and African communities. So those were not really, you might say, novel at all. But what you do see in the 19th century is that these legal instruments are interpreted in a way that becomes increasingly detrimental to African polities and increasingly discriminatory, exclusionary, and racist. And this is, I think, a key thing to understand, is that international law can be used for good. So it has certain universal tendencies, but also particularist tendencies. And I think also there are some really blatant examples of that, which is the doctrine of title to territory, which is essentially entirely of Roman European origin, but which is applied and still applied universally across the world. And so the instruments that we have of extraterritoriality, of doctrine of title to territory, were really closely developed in relation with European imperialism and were interpreted in a way that made them fundamentally exclusionary. So there is this this dichotomy in international law, and in the history of international law makes this really clear, of universal and particularist tendencies.
When I was reading through the book, I had a really a bit of a mixed emotions about it, in terms of there was the positives and the negatives. The positives were that you could tell within the writing and within kind of the historical records that you'd looked at and you'd analysed, that West Africans had a huge role, had an important role to play, and that needs to be talked about, needs to be discussed more. And that was a really key aspect that made me really quite positive about the general historical period. But then on the second level, it was looking at how, you know, although the abolition of slavery was a great moment and was a really positive step in the right direction, it did come with a bit of a caveat, in terms of the West African leaders having to give up a little bit of control and have to agree to cede territory and to effectively accept British rule. And I think it shows again, although a positive thing had happened, that condition allowed for, again, that colonial expansion, that for those imperialist ambitions to take effect. And I think that's something I did definitely want to look at, in terms of a lot of these positive developments that we saw in international law had that colonial influence that really affected the process.
Yeah, so what really struck me is also this dark side that there is to abolitionism. And so abolitionism has often been hailed as this major, often also British achievement, as in this success story where Britain takes the lead to expunge the slave trade and eventually also slavery from the West. And there's a really dark side to that story. And certainly many abolitionists were also really moved by a real concern and abhorrence for the slave trade and for slavery. And there were also a number of abolitionists in the British government. But there was also, I think, a very real difference between them arguing that on this spiritual level, all men are created equal, but then also accepting that on a cultural level, Africans and Europeans were equal in a temporal sense. So also among abolitionists, there was this real paternalistic sense that commerce and agriculture would raise Africa's level of civilization, and that Europeans were ultimately also responsible to lead that process, you know, so this process of advancement, you might say. So in that sense, I think you might say that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? And so apart from these abolitionists, the discourse of abolitionism was so pervasive in British society that for some opportunists, it certainly also then becomes an easy excuse to further less than humanitarian goals. And certainly what I've come across is many times arguments that would conflate this need to extend commerce and abolition, and that were used by imperial officials to argue in favor of the use of force or to justify cessions of African territories, and that would really use the abolition of the slave trade as an excuse to further their own less than humanitarian interests.
As we come to a close for this interview, I'll be really keen to hear your views on how we could widen the voices that contribute to improving our understanding of this continent's history, moving us away from the typical Eurocentric viewpoints.
Yeah, so this is also one of the things that I'm really concerned with as well. And I think that legal history and history of international law can play a really important role here. So there are, I think, many levels at which the absence or the absence of, you might say, non-Western accounts of law and of history are detrimental to society at large and to the academy and to universities more specifically. And I think there's a level of decolonizing, as you might say, the curriculum and decolonizing academia as a result of that. So to think of a few examples, so I'm first and foremost trained as a lawyer, but I've also studied history, and I'd like to believe that that at least was not so long ago. And in my own curriculum, I encountered some discussion of legal cultures and histories of the Global South, but this was really incredibly limited. And if I wanted to know anything remotely related to global legal history, I would have to follow specialized courses. And I think that over the past 10 years, of course, it depends on which university that you studied at, a lot of improvement has been made. But still, at most universities, I think law and history curricula are still incredibly Eurocentric. And this Eurocentrism is problematic because, in a way, I think it suggests that these non-Western cultures and their histories are somehow not legitimate as a source of study and as a source of legal inspiration. And this has important practical ramifications, because what's happening is you're essentially sending lawyers into the world who also use this almost exclusively European legal history or history of international law as a frame of reference. And this is a real missed opportunity, because I do believe that history and legal history, a history of international law, can play important roles in stimulating a cross-cultural understanding and also in empathy building and character building in students. And this problem then also relates to decolonizing the academy, because the problem of a lack of non-Western law and history carries over into the academy. Because if non-Western law and history are not taken seriously at the level of the curriculum, it's also less likely that you will have PhD students who would want to research this. And you are also less likely to attract PhD researchers from the Global South. And then also, as a result of that, a lack of academics from the Global South, which then in turn affects all academic institutions, ranging from conferences to journals to publications, where the Global South, but also people of color, are underrepresented.
I think you made such an important statement there in terms of just how the discipline does, because of it's such a big focus on the Western history, the colonial history, has excluded so many different voices within the discipline, and not only just within the scholarship of international law, but on the wider context too. I think this is such an important conversation that needs to be had, and that international lawyers and international law scholars need to think about. You know, how international are we in terms of the way we discuss international law? Does it really incorporate the many different voices within the international legal system, within the international community? I don't think that is the case. And I think, Inga, what you're saying here is such an important message that I think not only students but international legal scholars need to hear.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And there's this really interesting work done by Anthea Roberts. So, is international law truly international? In which he illustrates that it clearly is not. And the way that international law is taught at universities reflects and in a way also enhances this, because you're indeed, you're delivering, so to speak, academics and future lawyers who feed into that system and who are raised, grown up into that system. And I think here, indeed, one way to tackle it would indeed be to award more attention in law schools, because this is really where legal consciousness is created, to award more attention to non-European law and non-Western law, more generally speaking. And I've also experienced this myself. So I've even encountered conversations where I talk about my research and the reaction is, oh, well, you know, this is fascinating, but what you're doing is so esoteric. And then I think, well, actually, or at least my response to that is also, actually, it's really not, because my discussions of histories of, for example, Dahomey or Asante are certainly as relevant as a discussion would be of France or England. So these ancient African kingdoms of Mali, of ancient Ghana, have as an equivalent, in African history, they are the equivalent of really France and England in European history. But sadly enough, nobody knows about them. And this is completely unjustified because they also played a really major role in European legal history and in global legal history even.
Dr. Van Hoole, it was a very powerful way of ending the episode. Thank you for your time. It has been a huge pleasure.
Well, thank you again for having me. And I wish you good luck with the rest of the podcast.
Okay, that was the interview with Dr. Inge Van Hoole. Before we get into the evaluation of the interview, a little bit of a correction during the interview process. I completely got my fiance's research wrong, and the description was all over the place. I'm not even going to bother to try to rectify it. It's not my forte. I'll just leave it as it is. She did some research on malaria. She was, as I was recording it, she was looking at me going, no, that's not what my research is about.
And she done a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah, done a great job.
Let's keep it minimal. She did a very good job. It was on malaria. Good.
Exactly. Very precise.
I think we're learning something here. Let's just stick to what we know and not try to explain things that we have no idea about. okay, so yeah, check out Diana Munoz's Twitter page if you want to find out what her research is about, because I'm clearly not the person that should be explaining anything along those lines. Okay. back to what's really important, which was the interview. I find it a really fascinating interview. There's a lot of things to dissect and a lot of things to talk about. So first of all, I want to just reflect on the idea of the conversation and the way international law is talked about. And it's dominated by that Western ex-colonial voice. And Inga's work really does a great job of explaining or exploring and fleshing that idea out in terms of the way in which international law is described during this period is very much Western dominated. The voices are Western dominated, and they've definitely, I think I'd say they've exaggerated their perspective and the role they've had and downplayed how much, for example, look at kind of a regional issue with West Africa, downplayed how much of an influence West Africans have actually had in the day-to-day workings of international law. And I think that is something really important that needs to be challenged. And we talk about the fact that the voices of this period isn't, Western dominated. There are other voices, there are other perspectives that need to be taken into account if we really want to have a proper understanding of what was going on and to actually have a really global outlook and a really global discipline. So that's, for me, kind of a lot of the things that I was interested in. Anique, what's kind of the big takeaway that you had in terms of Inga's interview?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, the whole topic was really fascinating, understanding that West Africans played a really important role in the development of early international law in that region. It's quite enlightening, I think. I mean, most of the narratives are always very Western or European-centric, and that's something we'll talk about a bit later on. But I think something that really stood out to me was how efficient the British were with their approach to imperialism, right? I mean, they're a small island nation, and you always think, how such a nation could conquer or colonize a lot of the world. And it's because of that sheer aggression of efficiency that they were able to do that. And, the examples that Inga talks about in her book about the kind of fundamentals of international law, the model agreements, the contracts, all of these things that the British came in and kind of put in place were in order to enforce their way or negotiate their way in their favour ultimately, and persuading nations that by number, were superior to the British, but succumbed to, let's say, the intellectual powers that these guys possessed. So I found that really interesting, actually. And I think if you kind of extrapolate that forward in time and you think now to the concept of international law, and I'm looking at it from someone who hasn't studied it obviously as in depth as you have, it makes me think there must be an inherent bias in international law today, right? Because if these guys were maybe the likely the kind of winners of World War II, the victors who kind of who had the ability to shape the world afterwards through structures like the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, it makes me think now that international law is a bit of a kind of false name. It's a framework that's been developed by winners of the last war in order to create a global order that biases it towards them. So I found that quite interesting, Deepak. That was kind of what, these were the things that made me think. I'm not sure the things I've said are strictly correct, but it got me thinking along those lines, right?
No, definitely. I think you're on the right track. So Inga made that point of how international is international law. And I think that's such an interesting idea and an interesting element. I think we can look at, for example, the Security Council of the United Nations. You've got the likes of UK and France on that Security Council. While I don't think that's, you know, because they are still to this day maybe the kind of the big hitters, the most influential, the ones that are really going to shape the international landscape. Mm. It's more because of their colonial history and the colonial past. So coming out of World War II, they still had that reputation, hence why they then had a permanent seat on the Security Council. So I think that's, you know, an important point to bear in mind in terms of, because of that dominance of the colonial powers, they've definitely had or enjoyed a more favorable position in the international legal system. You also mentioned to me quite an interesting book about how the victors dominate the discussion. There's a book that you mentioned to me when we were talking about this.
Yes, so it's called After Victory by a chap called Eikenberry. Mm-hmm. And it kind of exactly what you just summarized, it kind of talks a little about what options winners of wars have afterwards. Do they kind of do bilateral negotiations with states that have lost? Do they kind of just leave and just go back to doing what they were doing? Or do they somehow create structures in order to kind of create a new status quo that locks people in, even though their power from a hard power stance diminishes over time? They can lock people in through soft power and still, you know, run the world in their favor, and so to speak. And so you mentioned it earlier about UK, France, you know, having this permanency on Security Council, and so do a few other countries like Russia. And they, over time, although like UK and France, their economic clout is clearly not the same anymore as it was maybe 15, 20, 30 years ago, compared to the likes of where China is now today. Or other emerging economies for that matter. They can use these structures still to push their agenda. And I think it's a really good book if people are interested in learning more about kind of post-war strategies for victors and just generally kind of why do we have these structures today, and what meaning they have past the rhetoric that you hear about the UN or the World Bank and the IMF. There's a lot deeper meaning to why those structures are pervasive in today's society.
I've got an interesting question for you, actually. So say if we redid the whole international system now, do you reckon it would be the same? In terms of, like, say we strip down the United Nations, we start like ground zero, restart everything, everyone's still at the kind of economic level, military level that they are now. Do you think we would have the same system, or would we still have the same people influencing like international politics or the economic world, international law? Do you think that'd still be the case?
I think we would still gravitate towards structures, but I think we would end up with more regional blocks.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, it always goes back to bargaining power. And so, if we were all individuals today and all scattered around the world with none of these structures in place, you would have some larger blobs and you would have some smaller blobs. And the only way I can kind of cope and negotiate with the bigger blobs is to create pacts.
Yeah.
And so the European Union, let's say, is one. Or from a pure trade perspective, you've got things like the ASEAN trade pact. You had NAFTA. You had a few other things. I think we would still gravitate towards pacts, but I think the shape of those pacts would be very different, because you wouldn't necessarily have UK, France and these countries making the lead. It may be more driven from China's side. And China actually today is creating new structures to quote unquote compete with the World Bank, the IMF. They've created their own kind of development bank. They're doing massive infrastructure projects, which are clubbing together other countries like the One Belt Road Initiative. So they're doing it in a probably purely economic way, whereas IMF, World Bank and UN, there's a bit of a strings attached political element to a lot of the loans or products they disperse to other countries. So I don't think that it would look exactly the same, but I do think we would, as countries, gravitate towards kind of clubs or team structures like the EU. And I only say that in absence of us adhering to this idea of utopianism, which is something you talk about in your thesis.
Yes.
I think if we were all very idealistic and assumed we all want to help each other, I don't think you would need this concept of clubbing together and negotiating and having stronger bargaining power. But in absence of that and thinking about man is competitive, man is wants to grow and win more and all of that kind of stuff, then I think you will gravitate back towards clubs and structures to control everything effectively, right?
Yeah, and I think kind of generally what I was trying to get to was, I think if you hit restart, those powers probably, or the likes of UK and France, wouldn't probably be in the same position they would be now. It would be as much. I think just because the colonial history has helped them set themselves up in this position. If we hit restart now, I just think, you know, some of the more developing countries, likes of India maybe, or China, because they're more economically developing countries, that's, there's something more appealing to these regions, they might just be able to take center stage a little bit more.
It's really hard because there's so many factors on why, let's say, Britain had the Industrial Revolution, why it became like a first advanced economy, why Japan went from kind of third world backwater country to competing with European nations at the turn of the 20th century within like 60 years. Climate, it sounds very innocuous but super important. Religion has played its part
in
the seeking knowledge, learning to read and write, the Protestant work ethic. If you reset all of it today, the allied nations have an advantage because they have this association with so many countries because of their colonial heritage, which makes all these countries look towards UK, France, Holland and these countries. From a purely economic perspective, the shape of it would all look very different now.
Yeah.
I mean, and from a demography perspective, a lot of the advanced economies now are at the kind of upper end now of where the age distribution is. And in terms of productive economies, they have their kind of demographic dividend when the kind of working age between 18 and kind of 50 is at its peak. And so we're coming to the end of that. And so technology is going to play a really critical role in transforming and transforming our lives in these economies and making us superior or making us, you know, more attractive to people to either work here or for the UK to have some kind of soft power influence in the world. Because we are, most of these countries now are very service oriented. Whereas some of these other countries like India, China, for example, economy is really big. It's a mixture of services and manufacturing. And it's a hard one to answer, but it's really, I'm loving this. It's an interesting conversation. We should have another session, like another podcast on this.
And I suppose that's what's interesting about Inga's work in terms of that historical analysis and accumulating and developing this understanding of this period of time gets us or allows us to really discuss so many important aspects of the various structures that we have to this day. We can really discuss and debate, you know, why are we here? Is it because of the colonial past? Is it, you know, the structural bias that we see in not just international law, but, you know, in terms of economics and politics, is it because of this historical feature and the way we discussed our history? So, you know, for me, that's why this kind of research, this kind of historical research has value. Sometimes, you know, I think definitely we've talked about how sometimes historical research can, you sometimes not necessarily can see why it's important, why it's integral, whereas With this, you can really see that really clearly. Why this is key, because it challenges the traditional conversation that we have about our past, and we can then really critically evaluate where we're going or where we are right now.
It was a great interview with her, and she definitely seems like, I mean, I say it about everyone that comes on the show, I mean, she's definitely an academic influencer today, and she's going to develop into someone that's going to influence a lot of change in the discipline she's working in. So I look forward to bringing her back on at some point.
Yeah, and what a lovely person. She was such a really nice person to have a chat with, have a conversation with. And the way she was so engaging in the interview, I think really made for a great conversation, a great chat. And I really enjoyed our time working on this episode with Inga. She was definitely a real pleasure to work with. And like you said, Anique, I think she's got such an amazing future ahead of her, where she's really going to challenge the conventions, the norms of international, get us to think about international law in a different way. So, you know, everyone, definitely check out her book, Britain and International Law in West Africa. It is out, it is released. So go online, go on Amazon, go on wherever, buy it if you can, because it is a great read. We both thoroughly enjoyed it. So I would highly recommend checking out the book, because it was a really eye-opening and enlightening book to just understand our history.
And please remember, she is from Belgium. something you all should be aware of, even though she works for a university in the Netherlands. So Deepak, what social media do we need to remind all our listeners about?
Yes, very important. So as per usual, we are on Twitter. So House of Wisdom, How Ideas Can Shape the World. Our Twitter handle is HOWW Podcast. Check us out. Interact with us. You know, let us know what you find interesting, or what's something that you'd like to see us maybe talk about in the future. And, you know, that does help us just get a good understanding of where we should go with our next episodes. Also, link us up with people that have a relevance to what we've discussed in the episodes that we're releasing. That really does help us get connection with the kind of people we need to maybe then promote the ideas, promote the experts and the academic influences that we're talking to. So definitely interact with us on Twitter. Like us, follow us, whatever that is. We're on Instagram, so you can check out all of Anique's amazing artwork. Sorry, not Anique's, Adam's amazing artwork.
I can't draw a defect.
Too many A's. That's what it is. Adam's awesome artwork. So Adam's done such great artwork, so check it out. And then we've also got all the links to where to listen to the podcast. Check out the website, hasslewisdompodcast.co.uk. We are on Apple's Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, what else? Google Podcast, Anchor. We're all on all those things. So just, you know, wherever you want to listen to us, listen to us. And yeah, keep following the journey, because it's important. We really want to do something important, make an impact. So come on along with the ride. Anique, I think you got one more thing to say, haven't you?
Well, it's a bit more than one thing today. So I usually finish on a random movie quote. That is kind of associated with the theme of the episode. But this time I took a little bit of time to read about the history of West Africa, and came across a really interesting word in a language in Ghana that I'll summarize it now, but it teaches us that we must go back to our roots in order to move forward. And that is, we should reach back and gather the best of what our past has to teach us, so that we can achieve our full potential as we move forward. And the word is Sankofa.
See you next time.